Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 31. Hello, and welcome to the Airline Pilot Guy. I'm Captain Jeff, the host of this wonderful Airline Pilot Guy show. I'm broadcasting live from Studio 508 at the Courtyard Marriott Hotel, right across the street from the LaGuardia International Airport, New York City, New York. I'm on day two of a four-day trip, and last night we flew into John F. Kennedy International Airport after going to the Cincinnati Airport, Fort Lauderdale, and then up here. And then today, got up early, flew down to Fort Lauderdale again, and then back up to LaGuardia, and here I am. Tomorrow, another Florida run. We're going to Tampa this time on the Gulf Coast of Florida, and then back up here to LaGuardia, and have a long layover, which means that I'll actually get to go downtown in Manhattan, staying at the Roosevelt Hotel on 45th and Madison. And I'm excited about that. I actually purposely bid this New York trip because I have a bunch of friends, Father Roderick, Cliff Ravenscraft, Anna Sophia Reinhardt, and others who are attending Blog World 2012, New York City. And I get to hook up with those guys tomorrow, hopefully. Should be in Manhattan somewhere in the early to mid-afternoon, and hope to get to see them and just go out and just have fun. Anyway, I mentioned I was in New York last night at the Kennedy International Airport, the DoubleTree, and I was, here's one of those little stories that happens sometimes to frequent travelers such as myself. And many of you probably can relate to this. I was getting ready for my early get-up this morning, and I was looking through, setting up stuff, putting things in the bathroom, getting my my DOP kit, my, what do we call that, a shaving kit, cosmetics bag, whatever you want to call it, deodorant, razor, shaving cream, although usually I just use soap. I'm a simple guy. So instead of using shaving cream, I just, lather up some soap and take the blade and do the job. And so I was looking for my little plastic bag of shaving items and other essentials, and it wasn't in my suitcase. I forgot it. I left it at home, and I thought, great, I can't fly all day without shaving. Not that I have a huge beard or anything. I'm of Scandinavian descent, so we don't have a lot of facial hair. Well, maybe some Scandinavians do, but I don't. My Danish background didn't give me a lot of a prolific growth of facial hair. But anyway, it would still look bad. And most of my facial hair now is the color of my hair and my mustache and my eyebrows and pretty much every other hair on my body, gray. So I called the front desk and said, hey, I forgot my, my shaving essentials. And she said, okay, I'll send somebody right up. And I went, okay, are they going to come up and shave me or something? But so this guy brings me this little package, this little like a ketchup package of shaving cream and this little joke of a razor. It was a dual blade. One of those really, really cheap plastic razors. It looked like a toy, actually, not even a full-size razor blade. And I thought, oh, great, I'll probably cut myself and look terrible. But I was very careful with it and managed to get a decent shave. And, I just thought I'd share that for some of you, again, who do a lot of traveling, you can probably relate. But today, when I got in here to LaGuardia, the first thing I did after I got to my room was change my clothes and walk out, try to find, using my trusty iPhone and Maps app, I did a search for drugstores, and I found a Walgreens just a few blocks away in Queens here, and I was able to get my razor blades and, razors and some deodorant. Everybody will appreciate that. And so here I am. I'm recording episode number 31. Sorry, I didn't record one last week. I only had a two-day trip at the beginning of the week, and I thought that it was going to be a little bit too soon to put out another podcast so quickly after episode number 30. So, and I kind of expected to fly a little bit more during the week, but they didn't call me out, so I just didn't record one. Now I have way too much stuff to talk about on this show, so I should just hush up and start talking about the stuff that you're interested in. Okay, this was in my list of things to talk about last couple of podcasts, and I haven't gotten to it, so I'm going to go ahead and talk about it quickly and then get on with it, and I can delete it. And the title of this article is Perfect Flight Seat Pinpointed. A new survey has suggested exactly where passengers would prefer to sit on an aircraft if given a free choice. And the study was carried out by the flight comparison website Skyscanner. It suggested that passengers prefer a window seat towards the front of the plane. More than 1,000 airline passengers were questioned on which section they preferred to sit in and whether they opted for a window, middle, or aisle seat. After filtering the results of the survey, Skyscanner concluded the most sought-after spot on a standard airplane is seat 6A. Now, for a lot of the airplanes, 6A would be a first-class seat, so no wonder they would prefer to sit there. The finding supports previous studies that have suggested that the front seat rows are the most popular for ease of getting off the plane, reduced engine noise, and a better selection of food. Nearly half of those surveyed agreed this was the optimum section of an aircraft. 62% of the respondents said that they would prefer an even seat. Okay, I don't know why. While 1% of those questioned said they would choose a middle seat instead of a window or an aisle seat. Okay, we always have some strange ones in the bunch. The results of the survey come as EasyJet prepares to charge for bookable seats. The airline is clearly aware of the preference for seats toward the front, as it now charges £8 for passengers to book seats in the section of the plane. The standard price to pre-book seats in any other section is £3. And finally, the least popular choice was 31 Echo, a middle seat towards the back of the aircraft. And I would say that it's probably one of the worst seats in the airplane that I fly. That's almost in the, it's almost the very back row in between the two engines. Yeah, I would not want to sit back there either. Okay, I'm going to turn my microphone a little bit. I'm noticing that I'm really getting a lot of sibilance, which is that snake S-y sound. I don't know why it's so bad all of a sudden. I'm using a little bit different mixer and a little bit different setup than I normally do. Perhaps that's the reason why, and I'll try to fix it in post-production. But if not, just bear with me and try not to pay attention to my sibilance. Okay, here's another one that has been in my list of things to talk about for a while. And I'm not going to talk about it because I forgot to download the article, but it was about a pilot arrested for carrying a gun in his bag. He was an off-duty pilot at Buffalo Airport, and he had a loaded gun in his bag. And that's not the first time that I've read stories of pilots carrying loaded firearms in their baggage. I don't know what this guy's problem is, but apparently they didn't take too kindly to it, and they arrested him. So he's probably had a lot of time to think about it. Okay, let's move on. Virgin Atlantic lets passengers make calls from some of their flights. This is from USA Today, back on May 15th. The airline has announced that it will become the first British airline to provide passengers the capability to make and receive phone calls during flights. Passengers were also will be able to send and receive text messages, emails, and have web access via GPRS. I believe GPRS is that, you know, when you look at your smartphone and you see the little E symbol, not the 3G symbol, but the E. So it's not quite as fast as 3G, but plenty fast, I guess, to do send and receive text messages and emails. Not sure about the web access part or the voice capability, but anyway, moving on. The new service will be available in all cabins of the airline's new Airbus 330-300 aircraft and refitted 747s. It will target business travelers and be limited to just 6 users at a time. Quote, the service is intended for use in exceptional situations when passengers need to send an SMS, make a quick call, or access an email on a BlackBerry, the airline said in a written statement. A BlackBerry? Come on. Get with it. Nobody's using BlackBerries anymore. Well, not that many. Anyway, by the end of 2012, the system will be available on nearly 20 Virgin Atlantic aircraft. There will be some restrictions, however. Passengers can't use the service during takeoff or landing or within about 250 miles from U.S. airspace. Of course, what's going to keep them from doing it? I'll have a little, I have some feedback later in the show where, again, a passenger was using an electronic device during the takeoff roll. And so, you know, I don't know what's going to keep people from using the service on Virgin Atlantic during takeoff and landing, unless I just, you know, flip the switch and turn it off. Perhaps that's what they're planning. Anyway, some industry analysts have said that having mobile service in flight would worsen the cabin experience. At the very least, the airline will have to restrict times of day when passengers will be able to scream into their phones, "Can you hear me now?" at 40,000 feet, in order to not wake up fellow passengers on overnight flights, said George Hobica, president of AirfareWatchdog.com. But you know what will happen. No one will listen. There will be screaming matches, glares, and probably fisticuffs. Okay, so we'll see how that goes. Let's dive into some feedback, shall we? I received this from Josh, and he sent this to my feedback at airlinepilotguy.com. Hi, Captain Jeff. Thanks for the great podcast. As a frequent airline traveler with aspirations of obtaining a private pilot certificate, I really enjoy hearing your perspective and getting to peek behind the flight deck door. I was browsing liveatc.net yesterday and came across a feed of the company channels at JFK. I took a listen and quickly discovered a whole world of cockpit communication of which I'd never been aware. Okay, let me stop that right there and let me let you hear a little bit of what Josh is talking about. Let me see, it's right here.
And 2984 will be at Spot Bravo, and it's in range right now, your aircraft, ship 176.
Great, Bravo, I do appreciate that, and got one wheelchair, we'll call ramp on the ground.
Copy that.
21 is your gate. It is open and available. That's going to be a Lima Alpha ramp entry once you cross the runway out there, 3137. You're going to come on. Make sure those flight attendants make that hot weather announcement for us about the blinds and the gas. We greatly appreciate it.
Okay. We'll do. Understand gate 21. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay. A little bit of a taste of what Josh is talking about. Okay, while it was clear that the feed was scanning various channels, yes, many different company channels is being scanned on this particular channel of liveatc.net. I'm pretty sure I heard flights checking in with their company channels on final approach during taxi to, from the gate, and at the gate on the pad. As well, the variety of information and requests that I heard was surprising. I recall hearing a request for catering, a captain getting upset after his 8th call for a push crew. I can relate. The company reps acting as ground controllers for the ramp, catering requests, lav service requests, wheelchair needs, release times for taxi and departure, and even a request for employee travel. Can you share some insight on how these company channels function and when you use them? I also wondered how you communicate with your company in flight and what those communications typically look like. Thanks again for the great podcast. Safe flying. All the best. Josh Chambliss. And he's from Birmingham, Alabama. And first of all, Josh, thank you for your feedback. And secondly, I hope that you continue with your aspiration of obtaining a private pilot certificate. I think you'll really enjoy getting up in the air and flying around. It's a great feeling. Anyway, the company frequency. First of all, as many of you know who listen to the show, I use liveatc.net quite often to try to find, if I'm looking at an accident, incident, whatever, I try to find the ATC recordings to go along with it because that sometimes provides some insight into what's happening behind the cockpit door and what kind of things we're dealing with and how we're communicating, et cetera. And one of the items on liveatc.net, you go to the left column, the audio archive, ATC audio archive, I believe, and then you can choose a date and a Zulu time for when the recording was done. And then there are many, many, many channels, and they're adding them all the time. And I just love the service. You need to check it out and support them in any way you can. Anyway, one of the things is KJFK, which is John F. Kennedy International Airport's set of frequencies that they monitor and record. And one of them is the company frequencies. And so I've heard JetBlue, American Airlines, Delta Airlines, et cetera, on there. And Kennedy is going to be one of those places that is quite busy with a lot of that kind of company chatter. And a lot of airports, especially the you know, the smaller airports, it's not going to be quite so busy. What do we use them for? Well, as you mentioned, you said you heard all kinds of requests, whether it was something about you know, requesting catering, or captain getting upset after his eighth call for a push crew, et cetera. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff that we do. Now, in Atlanta, Acme Airlines, we have several different frequencies. And so depending on what it is that you're needing to do with your company, for instance, if we're sitting at a gate and we need to push back onto the ramp, the our company provides the control of the ramp. And so when it's time for us to push back, we call them up and say, hey, this is Acme Flight 140. At gate B20, pushback with a UGA 3, which is one of the departures that we use. And so they know which way to push us, tail south, tail north, you know, what runway complex to head us to. And so they're kind of like ground controllers for the ramp only. And then once we are at the ends of the ramp, and we contact ground control, and that's when the federal government, the FAA, takes over and provides ground control service and instructions for us. And then we switch over to tower, and then we take off, and then tower hands us off to departure, usually a couple departure frequencies, and then up to air traffic control or en route air traffic control, the higher altitudes, and that's what we call center frequencies. But anyway, so that's what the one of the aspects of company frequencies. If we're sitting there and the flight attendant comes up to me and says, hey, Jeff, we need some catering, or we need some swizzle sticks, or we need some cups. Can you, you know, have catering bring those out to us? We can use a frequency that we call special assist, or well, a couple different ways of addressing the people that are on the other end of that frequency, and they're the people that deal with those kind of things. We also have maintenance frequencies, so if you have a maintenance problem, we dial in that frequency and talk to the mechanics and have them come out to the airplane and fix whatever it is that we need fixed. Let's see what else. Yeah, that pretty much covers it. Now, some of the smaller airports, like Buffalo, for instance, they request that we give them an in-range call about 15 minutes before touchdown. So as we're in our descent, while monitoring the air traffic control frequency, we have another radio that one of us will use to contact the ramp service people. And we'll say, hey, this is Acme Flight 140. We're about 15 minutes out, and we have five wheelchairs and two unaccompanied minors. And they come back and say, okay, your gate is this. And, you know, we have air and power, and we'll see you in 15 minutes or whatever. But that's kind of getting more and more uncommon for Acme Airlines, at least, because most of that type of communication is we use a system called the ACARS, which is the Aircraft Communication and Reporting System. I believe that's what that stands for. And it's basically that little digital data box that we use to send messages digitally, text messages to various parts of the company to express, you know, when we think we're going to be arriving at the gate and how many wheelchairs and that kind of thing. It's also used for our dispatchers to send us information about convective segments, which are things that the weather service puts out when thunderstorms are a problem or turbulence or whatever. So the dispatcher can use the ACAR system to warn us of those things. We also receive now our weight and data numbers that we use for entering into our flight management system before takeoff. You know, how heavy the airplane is and how many passengers and how much fuel's on the airplane, and it spits out the speeds that we need to enter for takeoff and that kind of thing. So that's what company frequencies are used for, and yeah, it's like a whole other world from ATC communications, but just one of the many things that we're constantly listening to as we are performing our job duties. Thanks again, Josh, for the feedback. Okay, let's see. I received this from Chair City Dave, Dave Derazinski. He's up in the Massachusetts area outside of Boston. And he writes, couldn't resist the subject line, which is electronic device usage on takeoff causes cowling failure. He said he couldn't resist it, and he sent me a link to this video. Now, of course, you can't see the video because, oh, by the way, I started to do a video, another YouTube video for this episode, and the bandwidth here at this hotel is pretty sucky. And I tried it a couple different times, and it kept shutting off the Ustream feed. And so, no video, I'm sorry. Maybe I'll do a little a teaser video or something like that and upload it, but the whole show will not be available on video this week. Sorry about that. I did try, though. Anyway, so because this is an audio podcast, I can only give you the audio of this video clip that Dave pointed me to. And so let's take a listen. This is a TAM flight. I'm not sure what TAM stands for. It's a Brazilian airline. And so let's take a listen. They're on takeoff roll. Engines are spooling up. It's an Airbus 320. Ah, listen to that great sound. Rolling down the runway. Gathering speed. Everything's going well. Until... Portuguese, I think. Father Roderick, maybe you can interpret. Okay, a little bit of panicking going on in the cabin. Okay, woo, exciting. Okay, what was happening is the guy was just like the Delta flight that hit the birds at Kennedy. Boy, a lot of things are happening at Kennedy. Anyway, this guy's pointing his phone, his camera phone, I'm assuming, out the window, and he's pointing it at the left engine on the wing of the Airbus 320. And the airplane's starting the takeoff roll, and everything's going just dandy until before they actually lift off, the the left side of the cowling on the left engine just flies up. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes so you can watch it yourself. But that's when you hear that big noise, and then you hear the guy say, you know, an appeal to Jesus Christ. And then the video just kind of goes, I guess he drops his phone or something, and all I can see is the back of the seat in front of him. And then they start yelling. And then basically toward the end, he points it back out the window and shows the engine again with some of the parts of the cowling, the outside of the engine, missing. And, of course, happy ending, just fine. The airplane flies just fine without the cowling on the engine. Although it's not designed to do that, and they land, and everybody's safe and sound. So, Dave City Chair City Dave says that the subject line in this headline was electronic device usage on takeoff causes cowling failure. I'm sure that they were being using tongue in cheek. Anyway, so I thought that was interesting. Thank you, Dave Derezinski, for sending that in. It was very amusing. And if you want to watch that again, I should, if I remember, to put a link in the show notes with that video. Okay, moving on. Boy, I'm really knocking these things out. Yay. This is from Chris in Boston. He sent me some voicemail to my airline pilot guy voicemail feedback line. And I think he did. Maybe he used the website. I don't know. I think he used my Google voice number, which is area code 304-997-4568. That's 99-PILOT, area code 304. Okay, so let's hear from Chris in Boston. Take it away, Chris.
Hey, Captain Jeff, it's Chris up in Boston. How's it going? I've sent a couple of emails the last couple of podcasts, and also sent you a couple of tweets here and there, just updating you on some things that I'm seeing out there. Just want to say thank you verbally. This is the first voice feedback that I've done, but love the show, love the podcast, keep up the great work, and God bless always. Couple of things. First off, just now finished listening to episode 30, and you were talking about seniority and new aircraft at ACMI and what would happen if a new aircraft came on board, and as far as moving over to a new aircraft or if you wanted to take on a new aircraft flying ability or whatever. I heard in the news today that ACMI actually looks like they're going to be or potentially taking on some of, I believe they're AirTrans. It must be AirTrans. They're 717s. And I was curious if that sort of falls into a new aircraft type of situation, or if they would offer it to MD-80, MD-90 aircraft, pilots and whatnot, or if it's a totally different aircraft altogether and how that whole thing works. So I'm just curious of that. I just listening to episode 30 and hearing you talk about that and also putting two and two together about the 717 possibility, I was just curious about that.
Okay, I'm going to put you on pause, Chris. Yes, that was in the news. That's been a rumor for quite some time at ACMI, whether or not we were going to be interested in... well, first of all, let me back up. AirTran was bought by Southwest Airlines a couple of years ago, actually, and they just finally completed the merger earlier this year. And so they're operating under the same operating certificate from the FAA, but they're still operating as separate airlines as far as the traveling public is concerned. But, eventually all those airplanes that AirTran is flying are going to be painted in Southwest colors. Well, not all of them. The ones they want to keep, the 737s, basically. That's what Southwest Airlines flies. And because AirTran has a number, I think around 75-ish, of Boeing 717s, Southwest doesn't want them, and it's been desperately looking for somebody that would take them off their hands. And turns out that ACMI is indeed going to be the airline that is going to end up taking over the leases on these things. And so both Southwest Airlines and Boeing are going to be doing the deal with ACMI Airlines. And good question. So all of a sudden we have another airplane. By the way, the Boeing 717. If you look at it, you go, looks a lot like a DC-9 or an MD-80 or an MD-90. And guess what? Those are all DC-9s. The airplane that I fly, the MD-88 and the MD-90, is a DC-9. That's the genetic DNA of the airplane. In fact, my airline pilot rating, type rating, on my airline transport pilot certificate says DC-9, although I've never actually flown a real DC-9. I've only flown an MD-88, but the Boeing 717 was essentially the McDonnell Douglas, the MD-95. And Boeing, as you may recall, bought McDonnell Douglas several years ago. And so they immediately changed the name of the airplane from the MD-95 to the Boeing 717. And so the guys that are flying that airplane, guess what? Their type rating says DC-9 as well. So what do we have here? We have a smaller airplane than a MD-88, MD-90, a little bit shorter. Seating capacity is not as great. It uses different engines. On the MD-88, we use Pratt & Whitney's. On the MD-90s, we use the International Aero 25 V2500s, I believe. The Boeing 717 uses Rolls-Royce engines. And the other difference on the 717 is the instrumentation. It has flat panel displays, much like the more modern aircraft out there flying. I believe it has GPS, but I'm not positive about that. But there are enough differences in the autoflight system control panel, much more like an MD-11 than an MD-88, and the presentation of the displays, et cetera, that it really cannot fall in the same category as the MD-88, MD-90 category at Acme. So we're kind of curious if they're going to just put that, lump that together with the DC-9s, or if it's just going to be a separate category on its own. Now, what I can tell you is I have seen already pay scales, pay rates for that airplane, and it looks like they're making it a different category. So if I was interested, if I were interested in flying the Boeing 717, I could bid for that airplane and whatever base I wanted to fly, etc. Probably be pretty darn senior on it because the pay rate on it is not going to be as high as the pay rate on the MD-88 MD-90 series at Acme. So I will probably pass and say, nope, no thank you. I don't want to take a pay cut just to fly a different airplane. So that is the deal with the 717. You are right. Those should start showing up on Acme's property. By the way, if you're just listening to the show at, for the very first time, welcome. Hope you're enjoying it. I refer to the airline for which I fly as Acme. There is no such thing as Acme Airlines that I know of. And I use that virtual airline name because I am not an official representative for the airline that I actually work. And so I don't want to get in trouble for saying something that may or may not be the official policy or opinion of my real airline. So I say that I fly for Acme Airlines. So anyway, we at Acme are going to get those Boeing 717s, and it's going to fit in just fine with our fleet plan. The company has been looking for airplanes in that seating capacity area, around the 110 seat capacity, and I believe that we're going to fly them as 110 seats, 12 first class, a certain number, I think maybe 16 economy plus seating, basically economy seating with a little bit more room, and then the rest, the balance would be regular coach seating. So let me move on with the rest of your feedback, Chris.
Also, one other thing, I know now that you have two other Chris's up here in the Northeast. I believe one was in New Hampshire from a couple episodes ago, and then there's also one down in Connecticut. I think maybe we should set up an airline pilot guy, Chris, get-together up here in the Northeast. Obviously, it doesn't have to be just for Chris's, but I think it should be for everybody.
No, just Chris's.
Everybody come, sometime when you're up here, I know you're flying to Boston, Providence, and Bradley, I believe, as well. I hope someday we get to meet, and hopefully we get together and share a beer and just hang out and talk about airline pilot stuff. So that would be great. That's it for me. Chris from Boston, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris, and absolutely we should do that. That's a great idea. Don't let me forget. And speaking of Chris in New Hampshire, I am going to actually be in Manchester. Manchester, New Hampshire. He wrote a book about the Manchester airport. So I need to, hey, Chris in Manchester, if you're listening to this show, contact me. I'm going to be in your neck of the woods on the 25th. Oh, I'm tired. 25th of this month, June 25th, Monday. I am scheduled to have a layover in Manchester, getting in about 5 o'clock. So, hey, give me a call or send me a text or email or something and let me know if you're interested in getting together. Maybe I can do a little interview and you can tell us more about the Manchester airport and its history. And Chris in Boston, Chris in Connecticut, and any other Chris's or anybody who wants to be called Chris, let's get together. I'm sure there must be a good place for beer and or snacks, dinner, or whatever in the Manchester area. That'd be a heck of a lot of fun. So great idea, Chris. Thanks for mentioning it. Okay, let's move on. Already, gosh, more than a half an hour. Yeah, I'm such a windbag. Let's see. I should put a wind sock in my windbag, but I'm not going to yet. Sorry. Okay, Channing Dale sent this to me via Twitter, and you can follow me on Twitter at Airline Pilot Guy, all one word, or Jeff Nielsen, my real name, JeffNielsen. Okay, Channing Dale writes, question, how thick is the rubber on plane tires since landing burns the rubber off? When do they get changed? Okay, let's see. How thick is the rubber? Well, it is, you're right, thicker than most car tires. And not only that, it has a lot more of the, what do they call those things? The plies, the steel plies that we, you know, before they had radial tires, they didn't have these steel reinforcement bands inside underneath the tread. It was basically just an inner tube and some rubber. And then as time and technology progresses, they started putting in these steel reinforcement bands to give the tire more better mileage and also more strength and more sidewall strength. And an airplane tire is like that, except for like way more steel bands or reinforcement bands and very, very, very strong sidewalls, because these landing gear tires really have a lot of side forces that they have to endure. And I have some feedback regarding that. But the top of the tire, you know, where the tire, the rubber hits the pavement, very, very thick, because you're right. When we touch down, the tire goes from, you know, 0 to 180 miles an hour or so, like instantly. And, of course, that creates a lot of tire smoke. And, of course, if we do it just right, we get one of those landings that we just roll it on, so to speak. You may not even see any tire smoke, and it'll just be, oh, I just love those landings where you just kind of touch down and you go, are we on the ground? Yes, the spoilers come out, and we're on the ground. Anyway, I digress. So yes, I don't know exactly how thick, probably a couple inches thick, depending on the size of the tire, the size of the airplane that the tire's on. I would imagine the 777 Airbus Super A330 tires are very, very thick rubber on them. Good question. And by the way, when we do our walk-arounds, our pre-flight walk-arounds, before each flight, that's one of the things we look for, amongst others. It's the condition of the tires. And if we notice that the rubber has worn down and we can start seeing a little bit of that ply from that steel radial ply, we have to make note of it. We have to call our maintenance people and let them know that we're starting to see some of that. And maintenance folks make a note of it, and they kind of keep track of it. And if it's you know, bad enough, then they start saying, okay, there is a limited number of landings left on this tire, and that number is usually 10 at our company anyway. And once it gets close to the 10th landing, then they have to change the tire. But usually they do it a lot sooner than that. They usually change these tires pretty rapidly once they start seeing some wear. Now, if there's no wear, no abnormal wear or normal wear, they can be on for as long as they need to be on. There's no restriction. So it's just based upon the condition of the tire over time and how many landings. But we don't actually count landings until we see some of the rubber worn off and we can see that steel ply. Okay, probably confused you more than I helped, but thanks for the question anyway, Channing, and keep listening and keep sending me feedback. And by the way, Channing has a podcast, and I apologize, I forgot what the name of it is, but just do a search for, you can follow her at Channing Dale, ChannindaLe, and I'm sure she'll mention her podcast on her Twitter account. From time to time. Definitely worth checking out. Okay, received this from Stephen Olensky down in Mobile, Alabama. Hi, Captain Jeff. I've been listening to your podcast for several months when riding my bike along beautiful Perdido Key. While listening to your latest podcast, number 30, I was amazed hearing that you started out at Mobile Air Center. I can't believe that I don't remember or recognize you, as I had a Bonanza and a Baron owned by my former company, Software Technology, based there from about 1985 through 2000. Okay, I'm going to stop. I wasn't there from 85 through 2000. I was working there back in the 70s. I was in high school at Murphy. Let's see, I graduated in 77, so probably starting about 74, 75 through 77, I was working at Mobile Air Center at Bates Field at the time. That's what we called it. And I was there for Hurricane Frederick in 1979, went right over my house. And I also spent a bunch of time up there at the airport helping try to put together all the different pieces of airplanes that were jumbled up in the hangars that we had. That it was a mess. That was the first and I hope only time I ever witness a hurricane firsthand. Thought it was going to be a lot of fun, and after it, not a lot of fun. I'm not going to do that again. Anyway, so that's why you didn't recognize me or see me. Even if you did know who I was back then, it's many, many, many years later, and I look a lot older now, so you wouldn't recognize me anyway. Anyway, I really enjoy your podcast, find it both informative and entertaining. I have flown as a private pilot for the past 30 years and never really knew the behind the scenes of the professional airline pilot world. I guess all of us private pilots wish we would have turned professional at one time or another. Okay, and this is Jeff speaking again. You know, flying, the world that you fly in as a private pilot is really so much different. I mean, there are a lot of things that we share, of course. You know, basic aerodynamics and working with air traffic control and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But the actual flying is so much different. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love flying airplanes, airliners, jets, that kind of thing. It's fantastic. It's a great job. I have a great view out my office window, as many of you know, because I post pictures quite often on my website and Facebook and that kind of thing. But it's different. And I really always thought that I would at some point when I became a professional airline pilot that I would, you know, have an airplane of my own and do a lot of general aviation flying in my off time. But come to find out that when I'm off, I have so many things to do. I have these podcasts to do. I have a little bit of, I used to have a printing business. It's not really a business anymore. I shut it down, but let's just call it an advanced hobby of screen printing and that kind of thing. And I have a family. Boy, I tell you what, that takes up a lot of time. You know, those of you out there who have families and kids and you got to take them from here to there and everywhere. I didn't have a lot of time nor money to spend on general aviation. If I had the time and the money, I'd definitely do it. I think that's just a wonderful world out there. And I really value those of you who are listening to the podcast who are not airline pilots but are general aviation pilots, because it kind of helps me live through you guys vicariously. So anyway, moving on. I'm still a very active IFR private pilot. This is Stephen writing now. I was lucky enough to move to Perdido Key, Florida about 5 years ago. That's a beautiful place. And now have a 2008 Cessna Corvallis 400, nice, based at JKA, which is Gulf Shores, another beautiful place. If you're ever in the area, please get in touch and we can go flying or fishing. My treat. Awesome. I love both of those. I'll do that, Stephen. I post a few aviation videos every now and then at, and he has a link here. You can just do a search for Fun Pilot 2, F-U-N-P-I-L-O-T 2, the numeral 2, on YouTube. I'll put a link in the show notes. And I went over there and looked at some of your videos, and that's fantastic. Great videos, and really takes me back to my general aviation flying days. Anyway, he signs off. Looking forward to hearing from you, Stephen Olinsky, President, Online Information Services, down in Perdido Key, Florida. Awesome place. In fact, when I was a teenager in my youth group at my church there in Mobile, we'd go on retreats, I think in the summertime, to Perdido Key or Perdido Bay or something like that. It was a beautiful place to enjoy nature. Okay, moving on. Kobe. I'm Kobe. No, I'm not. I'm Jeff. But Kobe writes from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm Kobe, named after Kobe Bryant, and I'm loving the podcast. I listen to it while flying as a passenger and whenever I can. His bio. I'm 15 years old. I'm currently living in central Alaska. I'm a very frequent flyer, and I'm going to start flight lessons soon. Yay! I've logged many sim hours and have hand-flown a few 172s, a 150, and a Piper 28 Warrior II. I'm currently taking local ground school at the university, and I have wanted to be a pilot since I was 5. Wow, I think you got me beat, Kobe. I don't think I was quite 5 when I... Well, you know, I may have been that young when I decided I wanted to be a pilot, too. I don't know, but... Anyway, moving on. When I have free time, I end up usually on the simulator, reading about flying, studying aircraft, aircraft procedures, systems, and things of that nature. I just recently also got a hold of some FCOMs from the ATR 72 series turboprop. I don't know what that is. What's an FCOMS? Flight Crew Operation Manual something? I don't know. Kobe, write me back. What's an FCOM or FCOMS? I enjoy your podcast. It's always fun to get the update in the airline world on the go. Question. I have found myself more interested in turboprops than jets. Would it be a good idea to stay at a regional airline for an extended period of time? Considering that management isn't the best and the aircraft aren't in the greatest condition and the pay is low for how much flying you do in one day. Okay, well, where do I start here? I wouldn't say necessarily that the airplanes aren't in good condition. Now, that may be true at some regional airlines that kind of push the limits of what is airworthy and what isn't. But, I think most of the regional airlines out there flying turboprops are doing a fine job of maintaining them. So that's kind of unfair to say. But you're right. They don't make as much money as the guys flying in the majors. And you're also right that they generally work harder than we do. It's one of the weird things about the commercial airline pilot world. It seems that, for the most part, the people that are making the most money are doing the least amount of work and flying the best equipment. That's just the way it is for some reason. The people who are working the hardest out there are the people flying the narrow bodies at the majors, and like the airplane that I fly is the workhorse at Acme. And of course the regional airlines, the guys flying the turboprops and the jets, those guys are flying their rear ends off, and they're not making the same kind of pay rates that we are at the majors. And it's like everything's upside down for some reason, but that's the way the system works for some reason. So that's what we have to deal with. As far as being a good idea to stay at a regional airline for an extended period of time, well, yeah, if you're into turboprops and you don't want to fly the jets, sure, why not? I think, though, that a lot of this is going to, you're young, you're 15 years old, and you don't have a lot of responsibilities and obligations. You don't have a wife. You don't have kids. You don't have the mortgage. You don't have all the... Come on, guys and girls out there listening. You know what I mean. Things just get expensive the older you get. And, you know, you may need to move on to the majors, if that's an option for you, to, you know, make a little bit more money so you can pay for all this stuff. But, yeah, if that's not a consideration, sure, why not? You don't have to stay there. And you're going to be there anyway. The path to the major airlines almost necessarily now takes you through a little stint at the regional airlines for the most part. So, yeah, check it out. If you like it, just stay there. If it's a good enough living for you, then absolutely. Do what you love. Whatever you have a passion for, do it. And, you know, even if it means that you're not, you know, making tons of money, and believe me, none of us are, just do it. That's the most important thing in life. I think most of you would agree with me out there. Just whatever you have a passion for, and if you can make money at doing it, that's gravy. Okay, he ends. I may or may not end up joining the Air National Guard. That's definitely something I would look into. It's a great way to have people pay for your flight training, and military flight training is awesome. Great experience, and being in the Guard gives you a lot of flexibility, and you can fly for the regional airlines as well. So I'd definitely check that out if you have a connection there. And he ends, take care, God bless, Kobe, Fairbanks, Alaska. And I've been to Fairbanks, by the way, when I was in the Air Force. I went up there a few times, and man, does it get cold up there. Whew. Wow, very cold. All right, thanks, Kobe, again, for your feedback. My good friend Brian Pottinger sent me some feedback. You know, he's the one living in Papua, Indonesia. And I asked him about the Russian airline, the what is it called? Sukhoi 95, I think, Super 100, whatever it's called, that crashed on that demonstration flight. So he writes, and I'll try to get through the whole thing. He left me like a couple page letter here, so I'll do my best to make it through this as quickly as I can. Captain Jeff, I had wanted to try to leave you voice feedback via the new SpeakPipe option, but alas, I never got around to it. But I did want to give you some feedback on the Sukhoi crash near Jakarta. I'm also worried that our really slow and unreliable internet connection here would not be up to the VoIP requirements of SpeakPipe or others, although we do have decent luck with Skype if we talk early in the morning before everyone gets up and turns on their computers. When I first saw the reports on the crash, my first thoughts were, here we go again, another CFIT crash, which is a controlled flight into terrain. And apparently that's what we have. One of the biggest causes of crashes in Indonesia, and specifically Papua, is CFIT. I would say that more than 90% are CFIT. I use the term crash instead of accident because, as I see it, most of these are completely avoidable by using good pilot technique and following regulations. So I would say they are the result of purposefully not following regs and or company policy and knowingly doing something that ends in a crash. So I don't see how you could call it an accident. Anyway, I didn't follow this crash too closely, as they seem to happen all the time. I guess this one got international attention because of the Russian connection. Yeah, I think you're right. Anyway, I first thought that the Sukhoi descended into terrain and at some point went IMC and contacted the mountain volcano. That follows the pattern that I've seen over and over here in Papua. I've been involved in several search and rescue missions to locate downed or missing aircraft. I want to stress to your listeners that are pilots, or those that want to become pilots, that 100% of the CFIT crashes that I've seen have been 100% fatal. Another interesting point is that a large percentage of those are located very close to the ridgeline, within about 100 to 200 feet. This indicates that the pilot thought they were above the terrain or pass they were going through. It never pays to go IMC in terrain other than on approved airways or at or above the MEA, the minimum en route altitude. After talking to several pilot friends of mine, I found out that this crash was a bit different. As I said, I thought they descended into terrain, went IMC, and hit the mountain. This is supported by the fact that the pilot asked for and received permission to descend to 6,000 from 10. However, the common thought that I am hearing is that the weather was severe clear, with no clouds on the ridges. Apparently, the Russian pilots, in an attempt to impress the media and interested parties in the back, descended to a low level and entered a valley and was flying up the valley, turning sharply near the terrain at a high cruise or higher speed to give a good show to the passengers. At some point, the pilots were unable to turn quickly enough to avoid the terrain, probably due to a tight turn in the valley, and at the last second decided to try to climb above it, but were unsuccessful. That's why there was an indication of a climb. I do want to point out, though, that many CFIT crash sites appear as though the pilot tried to climb, but actually the debris field is thrown up the mountain by the force of the crash. I have seen the forward section or cockpit section hundreds of feet above the main fuselage, thrown there by the huge force of impact at high speed. Now, I get to put on my company safety officer hat. If you're a flat land pilot or maybe a pilot in mountainous territory, I would highly recommend you get mountain flying training or recurrency training. There are extreme dangers when flying near mountains or in mountain valleys. There are so many techniques that we use when flying in terrain. It would not be possible to learn as you go or self-train. I have about 4,000 hours of mountain flying experience, and I still receive proficiency checks every 6 months. It is very easy to get complacent with your flying, and it will reach out and bite you if you're in the mountains. We call it the frog in boiling water. If you put a frog in normal temp water and turn up the temperature slowly, the frog will not jump out. Will not jump out even though he gets boiled to death. The same is true of our flying skills or habits. We will slowly, over time, do more and more dangerous things. Margins get smaller, techniques get rusty or abandoned, and slowly we get more and more dangerous to ourselves and to our passengers without knowing it. Before you fly in the mountains, or even if you have thousands of hours of mountain experience, please go get some quality training. Hear, hear, I agree with you. 100%, Brian. Papua is the second largest island in the world. Wow, I didn't know that. Over 800 miles long and 350 miles wide. The area I am responsible for covers 40,000 square miles of rainforest and mountains. I land on some of the most difficult and technical airstrips in the world, and as I mentioned, I have over 4,000 hours and 7,000 landings in this area. That being said, I would not, and company rules prevent me from going to an area I'm not familiar with and flying in the terrain or landing on the airstrip that I have never been to before. We must take another pilot with us that is familiar with the area and airstrip to point out all the hazards that we may encounter from terrain, from wind to airstrip slope, etc. In my opinion, the Russian pilots were solely unprepared for the terrain they were flying in. They didn't understand the hazards, didn't have the needed skills or mountain training, and it resulted in the loss of over 45 lives. If we can learn anything from this and other CFIT crashes, it is train, 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 and never ever for any reason fly IMC off route or below MEA when in or near mountains. Very good, I agree. Also, Captain Jeff, I haven't forgotten about the coffee you would like. Oh, this is a personal note, I guess. We have some really good coffee here. It is grown locally in Wamina. That's the Balam Valley area, and it's fair trade coffee, meaning the growers and pickers get a larger chunk of the profits. The coffee I will send you is a local roast, although the green coffee beans are also sold to Starbucks, and they put their roast on them. I hope you enjoy it. Send me your address, and I will get it to you when I come home for a short break in just a few weeks. Ooh, I need to do that. Thank you, Brian. I'll send you my address very soon. Until next time, keep the shiny side up and the greasy side down. Your friend, Brian Pottinger. And again, he is flying and living in the Papua, Indonesia area that he described for a Catholic mission air operation. And boy, I really, really value your feedback, Brian. Thank you for taking the time to send it to me. And yeah, you're right. I think that this is what happened here. The Russian pilots were hot-dogging it. And the other thing about flying fast, as many of us know, the faster you fly an airplane, your turn radius becomes very, very large. So maybe they miscalculated the fact that while traveling at a very high rate of speed and trying to make a turn through the valley, they thought they could avoid this ridgeline and then realize their turn radius was not as good as they thought it was going to be, and then at the last minute tried to pull up and they hit the thing. And just a senseless loss, senseless tragedy. Okay. Let's see. Speaking of that, you probably heard in the news just the past few days in Lagos, Nigeria, an MD-83, very similar to the airplane that I fly, the same MD-80 series, crashed. A little bit older than airplane than I fly, but it crashed. I'm not sure if it was taking off and they lost both engines and tried to bring it back around, or if they were in their normal landing approach phase and they lost power in both engines, but they crashed short of the runway, about, 3 to 6 miles short of the runway, something like that. And, of course, everybody was killed on board, including people on the ground that it hit some residential buildings. Very, very sad. And they did recover the black boxes, the flight data recorder and voice recorders, and hopefully we'll learn something about what happened here. And my friend Ty Jefferson, I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Anyway, he's from Nigeria. He wrote me and said, have you heard about this? And of course, it's international news. And yes, we have. And he's going to send me any information that he can find, because he's on the ground, literally there, very close by in Nigeria. But our thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the victims and the victims themselves. We hope that they're doing fine in the afterlife. Oh, I spoke earlier about Channing Dale asked me about tires, and then I talked about the sidewall strength of these things, because it has to these tires have to endure a lot of side loading. And Jeremy Beckman sent me some feedback at airlinepilotguy.com. And he said, "Hi, Jeff. Thanks for the podcast. Love listening." Thank you. "I saw this recent post on YouTube. Could you take a look and comment on why the pilot did not return to the gate or check on this issue? Seems like something went not as expected." And he has a link to YouTube. And it's one that I actually have talked about before, Jeremy, on a previous podcast. Somebody else pointed me to this. And this actually occurred a couple of years ago. I think it was 2009 out of Norfolk, Virginia, KORF. And it was an airplane, a Delta airplane, that was an MD-88 taking the runway. And as it was kind of putting the power on, it started, trying to straighten out the front of the airplane, the nose of the airplane, down the runway, and had the tiller cranked all the way and was kind of sliding, and it was causing a lot of friction and a lot of tire smoke, and finally got the thing straightened out and continued the takeoff, and all was well. And although it looked like it was pretty impressive in a negative way, I don't think there was a lot of damage done to the nose gear tire. There was some smoke and stuff, but again, there's a lot of rubber on these things. From my perspective, going around the turn a little bit tight, sometimes the friction on the runway, there's a lot of rubber deposits and that kind of thing. You don't have the bite on the pavement that you or the concrete that you'd like. And so sometimes you slide a little bit, and it probably wasn't apparent to the pilots that they were, skidding that badly and, putting out all the smoke from the tire. Had they known that, they may not have taken off. But again, I don't think it was a big deal. And so anyway, thanks for sending that in. And something looks like something didn't go as expected. But again, I've been in that spot before, especially when the runway is wet and you're trying to straighten out the airplane, a lot of side loading going on, and your nose wheel starts skidding, and you just have to kind of ease off the tiller and straighten the nose wheel out and get the thing going again and stop skidding. And that's all I can really say about that. But I do thank you for pointing that out to me, Jeremy, and keep listening and sending me feedback. Appreciate it. Jen in Northern California sent this to me via, I don't know if she sent this via Facebook or Twitter or whatever, but maybe a good old email. This happened in Seattle just a few days ago. 3-year-old boy who refused to use his seatbelt never got off the ground when he and his father boarded an Alaska Airlines flight at an airport in Seattle. The pilot returned to the gate at the Seattle Tacoma Airport, SeaTac, on Saturday and asked the father and the boy to get off. Alaska says it was a matter of safety and the pilot would rather deal with it on the ground than in mid-flight. The father of Everett Washington says the crew overreacted. Yanchuk also said the airline didn't provide a reason for being kicked out. This is a quote from him. Kids crying, people snoring, large, smelly people. We deal with it. It's normal. He said his son was crying and being cranky. I started putting him in his seat. I put his seatbelt on, but he was being cranky, trying to be close to me, so he wasn't fully fastened yet. Okay, wait a minute. He put a seatbelt on, but he wasn't fully fastened yet. I don't know what that means. Sounds like rationalization to me. He also recalled a lady yelling at the child, which got him more agitated. He added that after they were off the plane, his son recommended not flying. That's a good idea. Your son's smart. I think the whole ordeal just scared him off, Yanchuk said. He didn't want to fly again. He said, Dad, let's go home. Alaska Airlines extended an offer to place the family on another flight. Well, good for them. And yeah, if you can't follow the rules, there are no exceptions. You have to follow the rules. And if you don't, then you have to face the consequence. So thanks, Jen, for sending that in. And let's see, I know I have some more feedback, so let me go over here to my soundboard. Oh yeah, I got this from Mark Labrowski. Let's listen to Mark.
Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Mark Labrowski, giving you a big shout-out from all the folks flying low and slow under the Class Bravo shelf just north of Charlotte Douglas International Airport over beautiful Lake Norman, a place you have undoubtedly seen if you have flown the Victor Airways above or the approaches and departures to and from KCLT. All of my pilot and non-pilot friends that engage in hangar-lying, I mean flying, at the local FBO after a day of stick and rudder listen to your podcast, while the only two airline pilots I know don't. They're lost. This begs the question, are most of your listeners GA pilots and or general aviation people in general? In my experience, they are, and we'd like to hear a little bit of your take on things going on in the under 12,500-pound category, where most of us live. After all, every pilot came from there in primary flight training, and I'm sure many student pilots do listen to your podcast. AOPA's Never Again series, gleaned right out of the NTSB reports, was always a good listen, but they have not done any new broadcasts in a long while. A short segment like that from you, since you have that investigative notch in your belt, combined with your take on it, would be great. I'm not looking to add to your workload here, and we all certainly really appreciate all the work you put into your wonderful podcast, but man, that would be really cool. Although many light aircraft pilots aspire to be jet jockeys whizzing through the flight levels, there are plenty of pilots that fly the big iron for a living that love to get into a Cub or a Cessna and get back into the stick and rudder flying they once enjoyed. One of my airline pilot friends says he feels more like a manager of flight systems than a pilot, which is why he is frequently seen strapping into a Satabia at our local airport just to get his feet on rudder pedals that actually require his input in the turns. An old pilot friend once told me a story he called The Circle of Aviation. He said that a pilot of a Yellow Piper Cub doing a pre-flight on his ride looks over at a King Air ready to take off and thinks, wow, I'd really like to be flying that. The King Air pilot is eyeballing the Learjet that just rotated and is climbing out like a bullet and thinks, wow, I'd really like to be flying that. The Lear pilot sees a 777 up above and thinks, wow, I'd really like to be flying that. All the while, the 777 pilot is looking down at the airport, sees that bright little yellow Cub and thinks, wow, I'd really love to be flying that right now. So from all of us at 17,999 MSL and below, committing acts of aviation on the fringes of Class Bs everywhere, thank you for your insight. We all appreciate it immensely. Thanks again.
Thanks for your feedback, Mark. And God, well, yeah, he has a great voice, doesn't he? Sounds like a radio guy. Anyway, yeah, I'm familiar with Lake Norman and that area. In fact, my oldest daughter attends Belmont Abbey and has an apartment in that area, and it's beautiful in north of Charlotte area. And, yeah, the circle of aviation, or whatever you called it, is so, I really chuckled when I heard you say that, because it is so true. The grass is always greener on the other side, isn't it? And as I mentioned in a previous comment on this podcast, that you know, I really do miss that general aviation flying, you know, getting the feet on the rudder pedals and, you know, requiring the push of the rudder for a coordinated turn and that kind of thing. And I can, relate to that pilot that you mentioned, that's, you know, he flies general aviation because when he, in his airline job, he feels like it's more of a manager of flight systems. And that is what the job is becoming, and it's we're being pushed more and more and more into it. That's and if you've listened to my podcast, as I know you have, Mark, and many of you out there have, that's why it's so easy to get complacent and get dependent upon automation and continue to get more and more disconnected from real flying. That's why I am such a proponent of doing as much manual flying as you can. Now, I don't mean to go up and from takeoff to cruise to touchdown, you know, continually manually fly the jet because that can be fatiguing for the other crew members slash crew members. You know, doing it, I can't tell you again how many times I fly with guys, and these are guys that have all kinds of flying backgrounds, who, you know, I think should be taking advantage of actually actuating the controls, you know, the stick and rudder. Okay, mostly stick, and not really stick, yoke. And, you know, exercising those basic flying skills, because I think it's important that we continue to do that and not fall in line with just being the computer manager. And then, you know, what happens is, as Brian mentioned, complacency starts taking hold, and things start getting dangerous, and you start not paying attention to what the automation is doing, and then you get yourself into a situation like Air France 447. So, yeah, it's important that we pilots continue, no matter where we are flying or how we're flying, whether it's the Citabria, the Cub, if it's the Learjet, if it's the 777, we need to, you know, get our hands on the controls and actually fly the airplanes as much as we can. But your suggestion about coming up with a, like the thing that AOPA does, is great suggestion. And I know you don't want to increase my workload, and that's one of those things that I'd like to do. I just don't know when I'll be able to work that kind of thing in. But my, you know, technique or style of talking about incidents and accidents and trying to show you the back, you know, behind the scenes stuff going on is kind of a way to illustrate some of the problems out there, the risks of flying and the safety issues and such. And but I'd like to do more of that kind of thing. One of my favorite columns in Flying Magazine that I read for so many years was the I can't remember the exact title, but it was basically people writing in and basically fessing up that this is what happened to me, and I survived it. And well, sometimes other people are writing about people who did dumb things and didn't survive it. But it's important that we learn from experience. And I've always said I'd rather learn from somebody else's experience than my own, because it can be it could get you in trouble at the least, and it can kill you at the most. So, yeah, that whole kind of approach to learning about flying from either admitting your own mistakes or learning from others is a great thing. And that was one of the columns I loved in Flying Magazine. And the other one, as I mentioned before, Len Morgan, an old Braniff airline pilot, and he retired, and it was a general very active in the general aviation flying as well. And but I always enjoyed his insight to flying. You know, a lot of it was the airline world, but a lot of it related to other aspects of flying as well. And may he rest in peace. He died several years ago. I mention quite often a couple of his books that he wrote, which are basically compilations of what his favorite columns were, entitled Vectors in Flying Magazine. Anyway, so I do appreciate your commentary, Mark, and I think that you guys flying low and slow, the under 12,500 pound category, you're the heart of the aviation world. And man, I really appreciate you. And as I mentioned earlier, really love hearing from you guys and kind of living vicariously through your experience. An interesting side note, you know, I've mentioned that I really love the podcast, the aeronews.net. What is it called? The Daily Aeronews.net. I forgot what it's called, but it's a podcast. Just do a search. Just go to aero news www.gatelabrowski.net. And they have a daily podcast. You can find it in iTunes and subscribe to it. Paul Plack, for many years, was the voice, the host of the show. And he stopped doing it several months ago. And I think Len Moyer took over, and he's doing a fine job. But one of the things that Paul did, he had a good friend who has many, many flight schools, and his name is Bob Miller. Bob Miller Flight Schools up there in the Buffalo, New York, and Western New York area. I think he has like five different Part 141 flight schools. And they'd always do this special podcast, the special episode on Mondays, and it dealt with safety and concerns that Bob had and that he was seeing in training and such. And really, really missed that. A couple weeks ago, I was flying up to Buffalo, and I had the FAA, in-flight inspector. He works out of the Rochester office and lives up in the Finger Lakes region, and a great guy. And I'm not going to mention his name because, he was acting in an official capacity on my Acme flight. And so we were heading up there, and beautiful day. We were on descent and still above 10,000 feet, so it was still not sterile cockpit procedures. And I was looking out, and for some reason I decided to just mention the fact that that I know somebody up here who has some flight schools. And I thought, well, he's the FAA, and I know that he's a private pilot, the FAA inspector, and does a lot of that kind of stuff and kind of work. And I thought, well, maybe he'll know the Bob Miller. And so I mentioned it to him, and he kind of listened to me, and as I was explaining who this Bob Miller guy was and everything else. And then finally he said, yeah, I know Bob Miller. He said, in fact, he's a good friend of mine. And I went, no way. And I so wish that I had mentioned Bob Miller at the beginning of the flight so we could have talked about it all the way from Atlanta up to Buffalo, New York. But anyway, we got below 10,000 feet. It was sterile cockpit. We didn't talk about it anymore. And then when we arrived at the gate, the FAA inspector said, not only do I know Bob Miller, but, he's a friend of mine, and I got him in my cell phone. And so he actually called up Bob and talked to him on a cell phone and mentioned that I have this Airline Pilot Guide podcast. It's a small world, isn't it? And so he handed me his phone, and I got to talk to Bob Miller. And so I hope that, first of all, I hope that Bob and Paul get together and do some kind of a weekly or monthly or some kind of a frequency podcast, because I really, really miss Bob Miller and Paul Plack talking about these issues. And but in the meantime, I said, hey, would you mind if I interviewed you for my show sometime? And he said he'd love to. So that is something I hope to do. I hope to meet him in person sometime, but if not, maybe do a Skype interview and have him on from time to time if he wants to talk about things that he is concerned about. And as I said, so many of the things that he is concerned about in training and flying and such are things that I am concerned about as well, and definitely transfer and apply to the world of flying that I'm in. So anyway, I just thought I'd share that with you. I was like pinching myself. I thought, I can't believe. Not only does this FAA inspector know the guy that I'm talking about, Bob Miller, but he's a good friend of his. Moving on. Have some more voice feedback.
Hi, Captain Jeff. Oh. This is Brian in Chicago. I have a question for you. Who keeps track of the number of hours logged in flight? Is that something that each pilot keeps track of individually, or something that the airline keeps track of for you? Thanks for the great show.
And then he also sent in a follow-up email regarding this. And okay, logbooks. Now, I hope I don't get myself in trouble, but I think that I am required, all of us pilots are required to maintain a logbook. And I have a couple of those big black logbooks, pilot's logs at home, starting from my first initial flights and then 150, and then all of my flying in the Air Force, I have in a log, big thick logbook. And then I have some of my first flights with Acme in the logbook. But then after a few years of flying with a major airline, I stopped making note of all my flights in this logbook, because the company for which I fly has this computer system, and it tracks all of this stuff for me, because that's what my pay is based on. It's my flying time from block out to block in. And so the computers are already keeping track of all this stuff. And I thought, you know, why would I need a logbook? If I lose my job, if I get furloughed or whatever from this big airline that I've been flying for 23 and a half years now. Well, first of all, if I don't fly for this airline, if I get furloughed or whatever, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find a job with any other airline at my age, et cetera. If things are that bad that we're getting to the top 25% of the seniority list, things are bad. And so I thought, yeah, I'm not going to worry about the logbook thing anymore. And as I said, at any time I want to know, you know, how many hours I've logged, et cetera, which I have to know because every 6 months I do an FAA physical. And on the physical form, I have to put my total hours, how many hours I've flown in the last, I think, month or 6 months or something. I forgot exactly. But I go to the database system at my airline, and I go to the thing that talks about or that displays block hours flown. And I went ahead and did that right before I hit the record button for this podcast, and I'm trying to find it right now. Here we go. Let's see. Category block hours. Nielsen Jeffrey Paul has flown as an ACME pilot, calculated from GMT time 01 April 89 through, I wonder why it started April 1st, 89. I was flying before that. Huh. That's the first time I've noticed that. Anyway, it says that I have a grand total with Acme Airlines of 14,874 hours and 7 minutes. And I don't think that includes the flying I did today. Let's see. Now, 742 of that is as a second officer in the 727. So whatever 14,874 minus 742 is, that's time that I have logged for Acme these past 23 plus years. So I guess that's about what? Over 14,000 hours of flying time for Acme. And then I had about a little over 2,000 hours in the military. So I guess my total flying time would be somewhere around, getting close to 17,000 hours. So I did a calculation just based on my Acme time. I've flown an average, I looked back at my last 12 months, and I've flown 761 hours and 28 minutes. The last 6 months, 375. So basically per year, and this has been about an average figure for me for the last several years, I average about a little over 2 hours of flying every single day of the year. Of course, I don't go out and fly every day of the year. We can't. But it's a lot of flying, probably a lot of miles flown. I have not done the calculation to see how many millions of miles I've flown. But anyway, that's the way we do it at Acme. And I still see guys occasionally with these little logbook things. I forgot what they're called. You know, writing down their flight. And the good thing about doing that, and I wish that I had continued to do it all my career, is that there's always a little box in there to put something in there about, you know, whatever, you know, little note or comment you want to make about the flight. And I was looking back last month at my logbooks, and it really brought me back to some of those really memorable flights in the military, and some really weird things happened, and it helped me remember all that kind of stuff. It's like a journal, basically. And I haven't done that with Acme, and I wish I had now. So for those of you listening, if you're still earlier in your career or haven't started it yet, even though your airline is keeping all this stuff on its computer systems and you have access to it if you need it, I would still recommend that you continue to keep a logbook, and so you can make notes of those things that you want to remember as you get older, and you want to reminisce. Oh, we have some more feedback just received today, in fact, hot off the press from Vincent. And let me play you what he had to say. He had a question. Vincent, you're on.
Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Vincent Kemmer. I am a faithful podcast listener of The Catholic Pilot and the other pilot, all other podcasts of which the name I just forget. It's
Airline Pilot Guy.
Can't say that.
Yes, you can.
Well, anyway, my question is, I'm living in Brussels, and my kids left this morning from Brussels to London and then to Miami to head for Curaçao, where they're going to spend some time. My stupid question is, why does this plane, it's an American Airlines plane, but never mind, go to the north? Miami is on the globe, on the same level as Morocco. So why does it almost go to Greenland and then to Canada? There is a reason for that, but maybe you can explain to me. Thank you. Bye.
Of course there's a reason for that, and it's not a stupid question. In fact, many of us, look at these maps and go, why is my route of flight going, what? I used to fly from Atlanta to Honolulu quite often when I was a co-pilot on the L-1011, and, that's kind of one of those weird things, because sometimes we go way up almost to Canada and then, across like Washington State or Oregon and then out over the Pacific Ocean, and then we'd be approaching Honolulu coming in from almost due north, heading south. Sometimes, the next week even, we'd be down around South Texas and northern Mexico and the Gulf of California and then out over the, the southern part of the not the southern part of the Pacific, but, further south, and then approaching the Hawaiian island chain coming in from the southeast. And that really had more to do with winds, which I'll talk about here in a second. But now, as far as the flights coming from London to Miami and why it looks like it's, and it is, it's going up to the north and heading over Greenland and then along the coastline of Canada, along the eastern seaboard and all the way down to Miami. Well, the reason for that is, and you even said it in your feedback, you said the globe. If you take a globe, remember this is a sphere, it's a ball, and if you put your finger on London and then put your finger on Miami, and then you take like a string between your two fingers, and you'll see that this string wouldn't be like a flat line going straight across the Atlantic Ocean. It would end up actually crossing over all those places that you mentioned, and it's called the Great Circle Route, and that's actually the shortest route. Now, winds do play a part in this whole thing. Winds are gathered, are computed. There's a huge database of winds and models, etc., that flight planners use when they're coming up with the flight plans, and they always try to plan the flight to have the winds impact them as little as possible, or to improve performance as best they can. So, like if you're going against the wind, then you want to try to find wind patterns that are most beneficial as possible, light as possible. If you're going in the opposite direction with the winds, of course, you're going to try to find that jet stream core and get into it. I remember a couple times in the military flying back from Japan to the west coast of the United States, and it was not unusual to get into that jet stream core, and the winds were over 200 miles per hour. And that can really cut off a lot of time, which means fuel burned. When you get up into that, jet stream core, when you're going, against it, you don't want to be in there. You want to be as far away as you can from the jet stream core, because you want lighter winds in your face. Anyway, so winds do play a part. So I say that, distance and great circle route and winds all play a part, and also some restrictions on, what the air traffic control system is going to allow you to do. But that is the reason why your children's flight went almost due north and then out over Greenland all the way down to Miami. Another example is our flights from the United States to the Soviet, well, no, it's not the Soviet Union, the country of Russia, for instance, or China. They go over the polar region, over the top of the globe, And that, again, is because that's the shortest route. Now, when you look on a flat, I think it's called a Mercator projection of the globe on a two-dimensional flat piece of paper, it doesn't look right, you know, to go over the North Pole to get way over to Russia. You know, it looks to, you know, looking at it in a two-dimensional way, it looks like the shortest way would just be a straight line, you know, going straight across, you know, the Atlantic Ocean and then over Europe and then over to Russia. But in actuality, that would be the longer way to go. So I hope that answers your question. And if not, then send me a follow-up email to see if you want more information about that. Okay, and let's see. Now, I'm not saying that this is a recording of our flight because, of course, I work for Acme Airlines. But speaking of John F. Kennedy International Airport the other day, we were flying in and we heard something weird happening on the radio, something you don't normally hear. And so I'll let you take a listen.
5 on a regional jet, wind 0109er, runway 13 left, Glidewest.
13 left, Glidewest. It's American 1806, you said?
Southwest point is a report of a kite at 800 feet. The first side, first set of lead-in lights to the left side of the approach course.
All right, Delta 140, thanks. American 1806.
Okay, sorry about this recording. For some, I guess they're trying to get as much information into these recordings at liveatc.net as they can. And this particular site was using the left channel for, I think, ground control, and the right channel, the two tower frequencies. And so that's why. But this is a good illustration. You know, many times we are listening to multiple radio frequencies, and this is kind of an idea of what it's like when you're listening to your primary radio frequency, but you also have another one turned up, maybe not quite as loud, but you're hearing some other stuff going on, and your brain is actually, you know, cognizant of what is happening there on maybe a lower level, but. It can. We're trying. You know, they think that people have said, and I'm not being sexist here because there are plenty of women pilots out there, but women in general, let's say like our wives, will say to men that we can't multitask. But you'd be amazed at what we're capable of. We can really do a lot of multitasking. And what I'm saying is when I'm listening to. Communications panel in the cockpit, I'm listening to a primary radio frequency, a secondary radio frequency. I have the public address system channel up, so I'm hearing what the flight attendants are doing in the back. I have the interphone, two different interphone channels up, one communication with the tug driver on the ground, the ground crew, and another the flight attendants and their internal communication system, their interphone system. So I have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least 5 different, you know, communication channels are feeding information into my brain. Maybe that's why my brain is fried. But anyway, so getting back to that little snippet there, flight 140 was coming into John F. Kennedy the other day, and they said that there was a kite reported just to the left of the VOR runway 13 left final near the lead-in lights. And that's something you don't normally hear. And by the way, the couple flights ahead of us said that the kite was like 700, 800 feet in altitude. That is one heck of a high-flying kite. And what idiot is out there flying a kite in the flight paths of Kennedy? Well, probably the same idiot that's using a laser pointer at night blinding pilots. I don't know. Anyway, thought that was an interesting radio call to our flight. And the other thing I was going to say, lead-in lights, for those of you who are not familiar with that term. The approach that we flew when they're operating on 13 left and right at Kennedy, because of the proximity of Kennedy to LaGuardia, you have to kind of fly down this pretty narrow corridor, and you're coming in over Canarsie and East Brooklyn? And you fly along this pathway. And you start at the very end, you kind of curve it around, almost like the Hong Kong curve, the famous Hong Kong curve, but not quite as radical as that. And you turn, you know, make your right turn to align yourselves with 1-3 left or 1-3 right. And in order to help that, and eight, you know, the visibility is kind of low. And it was kind of, you know, we were in and out of rain showers and stuff. So the visibility was not great yesterday when we were doing this. But there are lights on the ground and actually mounted in some buildings that kind of are in like sequenced flashers, like almost like strobe lights that are kind of, you know, going one off at a time, like little rabbits that kind of draw you in and show you where your path should be over the ground to align yourself with the runway. So that's a lead-in lighting system, LEAD-in lighting system. And the person flying a kite was somewhere just to the west of the lead-in lights for one of the world's busiest airports. So, brilliant, huh? Okay, let's see. I'm looking through here just to see if we got everything, and I think we got pretty darn close. Talked about the crash in Nigeria. Had some great questions from listeners, and finally, yeah, that's it. I've been going for long again. I think this may actually be the longest show of them all. And but you know, it's been a couple weeks, so you can just, you know, cut it in half and deal with it anyway. Oh, don't forget, you know, you can listen to me, you can find me on iTunes, you can go to the website Airline Pilot Guy and click on the play button. You can find me on sqpn.com, the network of for which I'm associated and very heavily involved in. I do another show on the weekends called Catholic Weekend on Saturday mornings. We record that live. But I'm also on Stitcher Radio, and if you have a smartphone or you have one of those fancy cars that have the apps in the sound system, you can dial up Stitcher Radio and search for Airline Pilot Guy and listen to me there. Now, the cool thing about Stitcher Radio, it's not the audio quality is not quite as high because they do some compression on it, but the good thing about it is that if you're like me and you have a data plan and they start, you know, metering your data use per month and you don't want to use so much, you can listen to me on that and not use so much data on your data plan. So check out my show on StitcherRadio.com. Get the free iPhone and Android app or iPad app. And listen to mine and a bunch of other fantastic podcasts out there. So just check that out. I thought I'd mention that. Again, sending feedback, you can hit my Google voice. Why is it so hard for me to say that? Google voice feedback line. And that's area code 304-99-PILOT, area code 304-997-4568. You can go to the website and click on the little send voicemail tab. You can send me email at feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. That covers it. So, have a great week, and until next time, wishing you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care, and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network. Leading the way.